Last week, I read a true story of a woman who had been struggling with her faith for over 4 years. Eventually, she wrote to a pastor. She was part of a large church with many pastors, and she wrote to one of them and said, I don't believe anymore. And she wrote these words. She said, "It has been a devastating loss to me as I built my whole life and world around what I genuinely thought I believed, or maybe what I thought I wanted to believe." And she explained why she no longer believed. She said, "My trouble was that I see how sinful people seem to be living perfectly happy lives without God. Something I mistakenly believed for a long time that no one was able to do. To be honest, they seem to be living pretty moral lives too." This woman's concern might be one that you've felt or experienced yourself. Perhaps it's one you feel, but you try to squash it down, and you try to pretend you don't feel it because coming to terms with that is too painful and too difficult to deal with. This worry that, is it really any better to follow Christ than not to follow him at all? But this isn't a new problem. This problem of comparing our life to the life of others who don't follow God is an old issue. We read it even in the ancient book of Psalms in the Bible. In Psalm 73, the psalmist Asaph, who was, for want of a better term, David's worship leader in the tabernacle, or in the temple later, but in the tabernacle. And he himself struggled with this feeling. He wrote these words at the beginning of Psalm 73. He said, "Truly, God is good to Israel, to such as are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped. For I was envious of the boastful when I saw the prosperity of the wicked." Now, Asaph's situation was not exactly the same as the woman I mentioned at the beginning. The woman was concerned that her life and the life of other Christians, other believers around her, didn't seem any better than the lives of non-believers round about. Asaph in Psalm 73 is concerned that the lives of non-believers seem better and more prosperous and more blessed than his own life, even though he is a believer. And he said his feet had almost stumbled and his steps had nearly slipped. So their problems weren't exactly the same, but their problems both stem from the same fundamental issue. And that fundamental issue was comparing themselves to others. That is where envy and these sort of problems and concerns and worries come from. They come from comparing ourselves and comparing our lives to the lives of others. And that really at heart is what we're addressing this morning, particularly from this problem, this proverb. The problem of comparing our lives, the sickness, the disease almost, of constantly comparing ourselves to others. Now let me read the proverb again. Proverbs chapter 23, verse 17 and 18. Read, "Do not let your heart envy sinners, but be zealous for the fear of the Lord all the day. For surely there is a hereafter, and your hope will not be cut off. This proverb teaches us the cure to being crippled by the addiction of comparing yourself constantly with others. Just to say before we look at it in more detail, when it says sinners there, it's not meaning just sinners in the sense that we're all sinners. Everyone is a sinner before God. All of us do things which God commands us not to do. But when it says sinners there, it means those who do not trust in God, those who have not received forgiveness from God, those who are going their own way and have not submitted to following Christ. Ultimately, that's what it means when it says sinners. Someone who's still in rebellion against God. That's who this proverb is talking about. And this proverb gives us three steps or three instructions to us to help us not be crippled by that curse of comparing ourselves to others. First, it tells us to not let our heart envy sinners. Secondly, it tells us to be zealous for the fear of the Lord all the day. And lastly, it reminds us that there is a hereafter. There is a life after death. There is hope beyond this world. And what I'd like to do this morning is just look at those three steps, those three instructions in more detail, so that all of us can be cured or at least helped from the crippling effects of comparing ourselves to other people. So let's look at that first step, which is mentioned in verse 17. The author of this proverb, possibly Solomon, we don't know for sure. This section of Proverbs is simply called the Sayings of the Wise. But this wise person writes, do not let your heart envy sinners. Notice what it says. It says, do not let your heart envy sinners. Envy, of course, is a feeling, isn't it? It's something which happens on the inside. And you might be tempted to think, I can't control envy. It just bubbles up. It just springs up from my heart. And in a sense, that's true. Envy is a feeling. But comparing yourselves to others is a choice. And it's that choice which so often leads to your heart bubbling up in envy. Envy might be a feeling, but comparing yourself to others is a choice. And if you look at others and see how much money they have, how happy their family seems to be, how more successful their career seems to be, how much better looking they are, or whatever it is, if you compare yourself to others in that way, you're going to produce envy in your heart. You're sowing the seeds for that feeling of envy. And the author of this proverb here says, don't do it. Don't let your heart envy sinners. Don't let your heart compare itself to other people. It's a complete waste of time. It's pointless to be constantly measuring yourself by other people. And especially if you're a believer, if you're a believer here this morning, don't be comparing your progress with the progress of other people. God doesn't work in exactly the same way in every person. We all have unique trials. We all have unique difficulties. We all have unique problems. Some people might be seeming to be growing and flourishing at a rate of knots, and other people might seem to be walking through treacle as they seek to follow Christ. But God is working in both. C.S. Lewis, the famous author and apologist of last century. He put it like this, and he was answering people who were saying, why is it that some non-believers seem to be better and more righteous than some believers? And they said, surely that shouldn't be the case. Surely all Christians should be miles ahead of people who profess to reject God or to not believe in God even. But he put it like this. He said this. He said, take the case of a sour old maid who is a Christian, but cantankerous. On the other hand, take some pleasant and popular man, but who has never been to church. Who knows how much more cantankerous that old woman might have been if she were not a Christian, and how much more likable the nice fellow might have been if he were a Christian. You can't judge Christianity simply by comparing the product in those two people. You would need to know what kind of raw material Christ was working on in both cases. Do you see the point? You can't judge. It's impossible to look at two people's lives and to get a clear assessment of who God is working in more. It's a fool's errand. Don't waste time comparing yourself with others. Do not let your heart envy sinners. But the author of this proverb doesn't stop there. He goes on and he gives further instruction, because it's often not enough, is it, to simply say, don't do this. Because that's difficult. It's hard to just force yourself not to do a thing. Instead, if you want to stop doing something, the best way is to do the opposite, or to do something better in its place. And that's what Proverbs chapter 23, verse 17 says. It says, do not let your heart envy sinners, but secondly, be zealous for the fear of the Lord all the day. Be zealous for the fear of the Lord all the day. Don't spend your time, don't spend your life comparing yourselves with others. Instead, be zealous for the fear of God all the day. And I think the easiest way to explain what this means in practice is to listen to a conversation that Christ had with one of his disciples, Simon Peter, as they're walking by the shores of Galilee. You can read this at the end of John's Gospel. Jesus is talking to Peter, and he describes to Peter the kind of death that Peter is going to die. He says, hands are going to carry you where you do not want to go. And he gives him an insight into the death that Peter is going to die. But you know what Peter does immediately after learning this information? The first thing he does is to look behind him and point to another disciple and say, what about him? What's going to happen to him? It shouldn't surprise us, because just a few weeks previously, the disciples had been bickering about which one of them was the greatest. It seemed like the disciples had a problem themselves with comparing themselves to even the other disciples. And the first thing Peter does is point to the other disciple and say, what about him? What's going to happen to him? And Jesus responds with words to the effect of, what's that to you? What does it matter to you if that disciple keeps on living until I return? That's none of your business. You follow me. You follow me. That's a great definition of what it means to be zealous for the fear of the Lord all the day. It means not constantly looking at other people to see if you have their approval, or if you're measuring up to what they think or what society thinks, but looking at Christ, looking at him and seeing if you measure up to what he thinks. Are you listening to what he says? Are you more concerned about his approval, or are you more concerned about the approval of those around you? Oz Guinness was a theologian of last... I don't know if he's still... He might be still alive, for all I know. Someone can tell me afterwards. But he once wrote this. He said, "I live before the audience of one. Before others, I have nothing to gain, nothing to lose, nothing to prove." What he was saying is as far as he was concerned, his greatest desire was to be pleasing to God, to be pleasing to Christ. And in comparison to that, the opinion of others mattered very, very little. The wealth of others mattered very, very little. The prosperity of others mattered very, very little. Because he wasn't looking at them. He was looking at Christ and what pleases him. Listen to the Apostle Paul's words in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 3-5. Paul wrote, "With me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself. For I know of nothing against myself, yet I am not justified by this. But he who judges me is the Lord. Therefore judge nothing before the time, until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the hidden things of darkness and reveal the counsels of the heart. Then each one's praise will come from God." Do you hear what Paul's saying? He's saying, what people think of me is relatively insignificant. Not entirely insignificant, but relatively insignificant. Even what I think of myself, Paul says, doesn't matter a great deal, because I can deceive myself. What matters to me is what God thinks. As he says, be slow to judge before the time Christ comes back again. Then Christ will come and he'll reveal all the hidden motivations of people's heart. He'll reveal what was going on in people's hearts who seemed to be prospering outwardly, but other things were going on underneath. And other people who were struggling outwardly, who were poverty-stricken outwardly, were going through all sorts of difficulties outwardly. When Christ comes, will reveal that perhaps other things were happening underneath that you could not see. In other words, Paul says, look to Christ, follow him, and make that your chief concern. I don't know if you noticed in the last hymn that we sang, one of the lines towards the end, I think it was in the last verse, said, "Fear him, you saints, and you will then have nothing left to fear," or nothing else to fear. There's wonderful wisdom in that line. Fear God, fear him. Make pleasing him your chief desire, and all other fears will diminish. All other anxieties you have will dwindle, because your chief concern is him. It's interesting, I was reading in Exodus just this last week, and you'll remember how the Israelites were camped around Mount Sinai, and God, to some extent, revealed himself to them with thunder and lightning as he declared his law to the people. This is what it says in the book of Exodus. It says, "Now all the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet, and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. Then they said to Moses, 'You speak with us and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die.'" And I was really struck by Moses' response to the people. Moses said to them, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you, and that his fear may be before you, so that you may not sin." Did you hear the strange thing Moses said? He said, "Do not fear, do not be afraid, for God has come to test you, that his fear may be before you." Moses says, don't be afraid. Instead, be afraid of God. And he's saying exactly what that hymn said a few moments ago. Fear him, you saints, and then you will then have nothing left to fear. If you're most concerned about what God thinks of you, if you're most concerned that you don't offend him, then you'll actually live a happier life. Not necessarily a more prosperous life, Not necessarily an easier life, but certainly a more contented one. Certainly a less anxious one. Certainly a less one eaten up by envy and jealousy, because you're living before the audience of one. That's the second instruction this proverb gives. Firstly, it says, do not let your heart envy sinners. Do not let your heart compare itself to others. But secondly, it says, be zealous for the fear of the Lord all the day. Fix your eyes on Christ and follow him above all. But thirdly and lastly, he gives one more instruction. He says, remember. Remember, verse 18, for surely there is a hereafter, and your hope will not be cut off. The author of this proverb says that the final step, or a further step, in trying to conquer the addiction to comparing ourselves to others, is to remember that there is a hereafter. There is a life beyond this life. There is a world beyond this world. And if you are trusting in God, if you are relying on Christ, you have a hope which will never fade away, which will not be cut off. In fact, this is exactly what Asaph realized in Psalm 73. You remember how I said how he said he had nearly stumbled, his feet had nearly slipped because he was envious of the wicked. He'd seen how much riches they had and how much peace they seemed to have and how much joy they seemed to have in their earthly lives. And he was envious of them because he didn't feel like he had that. But then he said this in verse 16. He said, when I thought how to understand this, it was too painful for me until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then I understood their end. He understood their end. The people he was envious of, he realized what their end was. Right now, they were prospering. Right now, they were wealthy. Right now, they were filled with good things. But he widened the lens and he looked at their end. And then he saw things from God's point of view. Now, there are wicked people in this world who prosper all their lives. They break the law, they steal, they do whatever, and they never get caught. They never get found out, and they live to 80, 90, 100 years old, and then die peacefully in their beds. That happens. On the flip side, there are good people, righteous people, faithful people, who suffer all their lives. They go through chronic illness and pain and suffering and financial difficulties and family difficulties. That happens as well. But what the author of this proverb is saying is you cannot learn anything from that. That means nothing in the cosmic scheme of things. What matters is God's judgment at the end. What does God think at the end? Some believers in the Bible were wealthy and powerful, people like Abraham and King David. Other believers were poor and lowly, like Peter, who was a fisherman, or the thief on the cross, who was a despised criminal. Your outward circumstances say nothing about the state of your relationship with God. God sometimes blesses people with wealth. Sometimes, if you believe it, he blesses people with poverty. That's what the Bible teaches. Do you remember the story of the rich man and Lazarus, the parable Jesus taught? And he said there was a rich man who was wealthy and he fed sumptuously every day and his table was always full. But there was a beggar at his gates called Lazarus who would eat the scraps from the dogs for the table with the dogs. And this rich man had this wealthy, prosperous, successful life. Then he died. And the poor man, Lazarus, he had a poor, desperate, difficult, hard, painful life. and then he died. But we're told the rich man went to hell. The poor man went to heaven. Not because the rich man didn't go to hell because he was rich, and the poor man didn't go to heaven because he was poor. But the lesson is, whether you are rich or poor doesn't guarantee your eternal destiny. It's interesting, by the way, that we don't know the rich man's name. Jesus doesn't bother to tell us what the rich man's name was. But he does tell us the name of the poor man. There's a wonderful little lesson in there. What matters isn't your wealth, your success, your career, whatever else. What matters is, does God know your name? Do you have a relationship with him? And if you do, you have a hope which will never be taken away from you. If you've come to realize that you're a sinner, if you've bowed the knee to Christ, if you've accepted the forgiveness that he gives, you now have a relationship with God which will never be taken away from you. Whatever struggles and trials and difficulties come into your life, that is fixed, that is secure. Christ has gone to prepare a place for you, and that will be never taken away from you. And the author of this proverb is saying, remember that. Don't forget that. Don't look at other people and see how they seem to be prospering in this life. You can't judge a life by its middle. You have to judge a life by its end. And only God can do that. If I could put it this way, stop looking at your life and the lives of others through a narrow lens. Stop looking at someone else's life through your limited view, field of vision. Look at it from heaven's eyes. Look at it from God's perspective. And I don't know what you think of the film, if you've watched it, the film Prince of Egypt. Not everything in that film is exactly accurate with the Bible, but there is a song in that film which I think teaches a helpful truth. Jethro, Moses' eventual father-in-law, sings a song in. That's not in the Bible, but the truth of this song is in the Bible, I believe. And he says this. He says, a single thread in a tapestry, though its color brightly shines, can never see its purpose in the pattern of the grand design. A lake of gold in the desert sand is less than a cold, cool, fresh spring. And to one lost sheep, a shepherd boy is greater than the richest king. If a man loses everything he owns, has he truly lost his worth? Or is it the beginning of a new and brighter birth? So how can you see what your life is worth or where your value lies? You can never see through the eyes of man. You must look at your life through heaven's eyes. Do you hear what's being said there? It's saying it's no good trying to judge the value of someone's life by how much is in their bank account or how many people are on the payroll in their business or how high they climb up that greasy pole of business. You can't judge someone's value that way. The only way you can judge someone's value is through heaven's eyes, from God's perspective. To close, think of the great example in history, Jesus Christ himself. No one in human history has been favored more than Jesus Christ. No one knows more of the joy and the pleasure of God the Father than Jesus Christ. And yet, nobody has suffered more than Jesus Christ. No one had a more outwardly despised life than Jesus. Do you remember Jesus' own words? He said, foxes have holes, the birds have their nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. He didn't have a lasting home. He relied on the generosity of others on occasions. And then at the end of his life, he was crucified on a cross and despised by those around him. If you look through human eyes, Jesus' life was a failure. If you look through human eyes, Jesus' life was one which none of us would want to have. But looked through heaven's eyes, Jesus' life is the greatest life that was ever lived. Those 3 years in the despised region of Galilee were the most precious years that anyone has ever lived on earth. And his despised, hate-filled death was the greatest death that anyone has ever died. So that's the point. That's really the fundamental message from this morning. Don't judge things from your own small, limited perspective. Don't look at your life or the life of others through your own eyes. Look at it through the eyes of God. Read his word, read what he says, and you'll be freed from the chains of envy. You'll be freed from that addiction to comparing yourselves to others, because you'll be living before the audience of one, the only one who truly matters. Do not let your heart envy sinners, but be zealous for the fear of the Lord all the day, for surely there is a hereafter, and your hope will not be cut off. And with those thoughts in mind, let's sing as our final hymn, number 820 in our hymn books. And this hymn really does what that proverb encourages us to do. Encourage us to remember what we have in Christ, not what we lack in this world. It's 820. When this passing world is done, when has sunk yon radiant sun, when I stand with Christ on high, looking o'er life's history, then, Lord, shall I fully know, not till then, how much I owe. So let's close by singing 820.